We're talking with Lou Elizondo and Jan Harzan about 8-tip, all-sap, bass, TTSA, tic-tac, and a whole lot of other strange terms. In a moment, we're going to bring up another strange term, that is metamaterials. What are they? Where did they come from? How did they get them? And where are they now? We're going to jump into that in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Lou Elizondo, before we leave the topic about all-sap and how these things fit together, all-sap, I guess the bulk of the money that we're talking about was spent by a private contractor, by Bass. Did you coordinate with them? Did you have access to what they did and vice versa?
Yes.
And so would you have seen Skinwalker Ranch material, for example?
Yes.
That's about as far as you're going to go on that one?
Yes.
Okay. Let me ask a different way. Those terms, ATIP and OSAP, having words like threat and weapon, that sets off alarm bells for a lot of people who think, aha, let's say a UFO study gets renewed or recreated, and it is sold on the premise of these visitors, the Tic Tacs, the gimbals, represent a threat, whereas alien-friendly folks like us would say these aliens are not hurting us. Wherever they're from, they're not attacking us. They're not using laser beams to wipe out our cities. You, as a military guy, how do you react to that?
Well, I don't necessarily agree or disagree. Understand that the function of the Department of Defense is national security. It is designed to look at threats. Even when we look at things like hurricanes or even some cases disaster relief, it's to stop a threat. It's to stop the spread of disease or to stop some sort of threat that could potentially affect our nation. So it is the job of the Department of Defense, in its title, Department of Defense, to look at things from the optic of as it may be pose a potential threat. Now, I would certainly say that if you have something that is operating, let's keep going back to the Nimitz example because that's what most people are familiar with, despite being dozens more, obviously. But let's stick with the Nimitz. If you have an object that is flying in and near and around a nuclear carrier group, and that is displaying some very advanced capabilities and clearly displays air dominance over what we have, is it considered a potential threat? Well, I would submit to you any time a Russian reconnaissance vehicle, one of their strategic bombers, flies off the coast of the United States, we scramble fighter planes. We don't scramble Cessnas. We don't scramble the welcome wagon. We scramble fighter planes, and we do that because something could be a potential threat. Now, are we going to go to war with Russia? No, God, I hope not. I don't think we're going to. But nonetheless, anytime a nation brings an aircraft into our airspace, we scramble fighter planes. So to say that, the Department of Defense shouldn't consider something a threat, the department considers a lot of things a threat. So I think it's a bit disingenuous, and this is certainly not directed at you. I think just in general, for the public to assume that the Department of Defense would look at anything other than something that could not be perceived as a threat. Now, if you're asking me as a human being, do I think they're a threat? That's an entirely different question. But
well, let me ask you this. In all the dozens of cases, or maybe it's hundreds, you had indicated there had been dozens of incidents like Tic Tac. And we know one of those videos, a gimbal video, was, I think it was from 2015. But have there ever been cases, to your knowledge, where these things displayed hostile intent, where they shot something down or, knocked a plane out of the sky or disabled something?
Well, disabling something is not necessarily a hostile threat, keeping in mind that an electromagnetic pulse or radiation that is not necessarily something you intend to do, knocks out a radio, for example, is that really a hostile threat? It depends. I think the definition of overt hostility is something different. I am personally not aware of anything that has directly challenged and engaged one of our aircraft to the point where we had a loss of life. But that doesn't mean that air superiority by something else is not considered a threat. It is considered a threat. And look, I'd like to say one other thing, if I may, here. It's not really off topic, but you had mentioned something. You asked Jan a question about MUFON and if they should feel a little bit slighted because, you know, they're trying to make this thing a secret. And I just want to say, I think MUFON plays a very critical role here. I think organizations like MUFON and TTSA, but if you get online and just look at the goals, the mission goals of MUFON, there's only three of them. You will see very quickly that those mission statements that's not the job of the U.S. government. The U.S. government will never do those mission statements that MUFON is doing. You know, getting this into the public eye, that's not the government's job. The government's job is not to simply sit there and engage the American people about what-if scenarios and, you know, about the grandiose nature of the universe. That's not what the Department of Defense does. And when you look at organizations like MUFON and TTSA, they're in a far better position to do that. You know, investigating UFO sightings and collected data in the MUFON database for use by researchers worldwide, right? That's not a DOD mission. We keep things in-house. Promote research on UFOs to discover the true nature of the phenomena with an eye towards scientific breakthroughs and improving life on our planet. Again, improving life on our planet may not necessarily be within the mission statement of the Department of Defense. Their mission is to protect this country from potential threats. And last but not least, educate the public on UFO phenomena and its potential impact on society. I mean, these are huge mission goals. And only a civilian organization like MUFON, I think, is in the position to even begin to look at doing something like this. So I think between our company, TTSA, and working with folks like Jan at MUFON, that's really where we're going to get bang for our buck, because a government's job is very specific. Particularly the Department of Defense, it is not going to do a lot of those things that organizations like MUFON and TTSA are trying to do. We are a driver for change. You know, we serve as an interlocutor, a research organization, but ultimately we are changing the conversation in a way that helps us as humanity hopefully get a better understanding of what these things are. And I would say to you, let the Department of Defense do what the Department of Defense does best and protect this country, and then let organizations like MUFON and TTSA do what they do best, and that is to engage the public and get the conversation going and you know, ask some of the hard questions.
So let's just speculate. Congress authorizes some kind of a program. There's an aspect to it that's classified, obviously. Given the sensitivity of the information and these encounters, could there be a public information role for, say, TTSA or MUFON? Jan, does MUFON have a seat at the TTSA table already?
Well, not per se, but I mean, I feel like I can pick up the phone and call Lou at any time or any of the other members of the TTSA and ask for their help. I agree with Lou. We've got common missions. They've got the wherewithal and the funding to do some very significant things from a scientific standpoint. We're a nonprofit and rely solely on the generosity of the public through memberships and through donations to even exist. But we try to do our best to get the information out to the public that gets reported to us, and to synthesize it. In fact, we'll be announcing a cases of interest book this year, the first of its kind. For all of our cases in 2017, the 6,000 that have come into us, we put a window to that down to 240 cases we think are the most important, and we're going to publish that in a book here to be released at our symposium in 2 weeks.
Eric Davis and Hal Putoff have both been my guests on this program. Both have talked about metamaterials, unusual materials engineered in a way that presumably we can't do it, maybe created in zero gravity, where we don't have any factories, that were obtained in various ways. Lou, you and I have had this conversation before about whether or not metamaterials are in the possession of the government, whether they, this is what Hal has been talking about analyzing, whether this material came from somewhere else. Is it hard physical proof of some other intelligence? It came from somewhere else. It's not something that we made. Can you address that?
Yes, and let me see if I can add some clarity to this, because everybody keeps wondering just what the hell do we mean by metamaterial? And a metamaterial is actually a fairly generic term for basically something that has properties not found naturally here on Earth, okay? So that means, i.e., it's engineered and it has very unique properties, usually for a very specific purpose. So in this particular case, let's say you hypothetically collect some material, there's three levels of analysis that you want to do. So the very first analysis is a macro level analysis. Once you secure material, whatever this may be, just like a crime scene, and you're going to look at its physical properties. You're going to identify it, you're going to weigh it, you're going to photograph it, you're going to look at it, and there's going to be certain characteristics that physically you should be able to test. So, for example, you're going to look for heat ablation, right? You look at material vitrification. You're going to be looking for things, is it shiny, is it opaque, does it conduct electricity, right? All these type of things. Does it emit any type of EMF, electromagnetic frequency? Is it radioactive, right? Does it have uranium in it? Does it have strontium in it? Who knows, right? Does it have iridium in it? And some of that you're going to find when you go into the second level of testing, and that is at the molecular/chemical level of testing. And that's obviously a lot more detailed and, frankly, a lot more resource intensive, because now what you're doing is looking at the chemical composition, the molecular relationships certain molecules have with other molecules. So you're looking at its chemical, whether it's bilayered, trilayered, is it a mixture of some sort or a composite? And you're going to be looking at, you're going to look at its crystalline matrix. You're going to determine, does it have any unique properties that from a material science perspective is really, really unique? And then last but not least, if you start coming up with some really interesting stuff, like I said, you know, high amounts of iridium and things like that you wouldn't normally expect, then you would look at a third level, which is really getting a little bit more, you know, obviously costly, but it's necessary in my opinion, and that is looking at the nuclear level. You are analyzing it, its composition, and particularly its nuclear properties. So you're going beyond the chemical, molecular, and you're now going to the atom itself, and you're looking at that atom to determine if there's anything unique about those atoms. So for, let's say, example, let's take a piece of nickel, a shiny nickel, and in that nickel you would expect to have certain percentages of an ion present. So 2% ion in this particular, you know, that's found naturally on Earth. Come to find out, you pick up a piece of material and it has a very unusual isotopic ratio. It has a very interesting, the protons and neutrons versus electrons is not, first of all, it may appear engineered, and if it's engineered, it's certainly not found here on this planet, and is it something that we could, with our current technology, produce with that level of accuracy? So those are the type of things that when you're looking at the material, as you go further and further down the scale from macro to micro, eventually to nano, and obviously the costs go up, that's really where things could get interesting. So when you're looking at a metamaterial that has, back to the question you're asking me, may or may not have certain isotopic ratios, that's a big deal, because that can tell you a lot. That can tell you where something may have come from. It can tell you what type of processes that material may have undergone in order to have that, if you will, nuclear fingerprint. And so that, in essence, is a little bit more of a comprehensive explanation than I think the New York Times had when they first came out. And by the way, I'm not faulting the New York Times. Obviously you're not going to get into a 20-page description in a newspaper report about metamaterials.
I guess what I'm asking is there material that we have now, we meaning maybe TTSA or the Pentagon, that we can't identify who made it, that we don't know how to make, that maybe was... I think both Hal and Eric Davis suggested that it might have been picked up from a crash site and been analyzed.
Mr. Nat, I'm very, very, I am cautiously optimistic that we may have hopefully some news forthcoming to that topic. I don't want to say yes or no. You asked me about TTSA. We have a lot of ongoing projects, very exciting ongoing projects right now. Just because we don't talk about them doesn't mean they're not going on. We have a lot of very interesting things going on behind the door, and those things will t- come to fruition. Keeping in mind, this is not a sprint, this is a marathon, and I want to make sure that people understand that we dot our I's, cross our T's, we check, double check, and even triple check everything that we do before we make any type of proclamation or announcement. Because the worst thing you ever want to do is come out with an announcement prematurely and you haven't done all your homework. So as much as I would love to come out here and tell you all the wonderful things that we're working on, I don't want to do that yet. I will tell you that TTSA is in the middle of some very, very interesting projects that I'm absolutely thrilled to be part of. And I think, I don't want to speak for Hal Pudoff because obviously he has a heck of a lot more scientific background than I do. But I think what he said recently at the
science SSE,
right. Forum that he just spoke at not too long ago. If you want to know a little bit about more, I would encourage your audience to go look at what he had to say.
Well, let me ask you this. The day after I came down to see you and interview you, there was a photo that appeared on social media distributed by TTSA. It shows smiling Lou Elizondo in between Hal Pudoff and Eric Davis. And I don't remember what the exact caption said, but the indication was that you had brought something to them to analyze. The question would be, is TTSA actively collecting strange material that may or may not be from a crash site or from somewhere else and having analysis done on it to look for things that truly would be mysterious and unknown?
Boy, can I buy a vowel?
Yeah.
We're doing a lot, George. We're working very, very hard, and we're working with some great people. I think if people knew just the level of cooperation we had with other folks, I think they would be pleasantly surprised. Keeping in mind that sometimes you have to protect people's privacy, and that's exactly what we're going to do. We want to present information and data and results in a way that gets the information out, but at the same time protects the individuals who want their identity protected.
Well, let me ask it in a sneakier way then. If there's somebody in our audience who's got a piece of Roswell material or, something that Granddad stashed away from a crash site that he said he went to, does TTSA want to see that and talk to
people? Yes, we are absolutely prepared to secure that material. In essence, what would happen is that material then, hypothetically we're speaking, of course, we would take an insurance policy out for that material. Payable to them, so if anything happened while it was in our possession, they are protected. And we would secure the material ourselves. We sign a contract saying that the material remains their property. They agree to allow us to do non-destructive testing on it, and we would do analysis on it, very much in the same way that I just described to you, starting at the macro level down to the micro. And the results of that material is shared with not only us, but back to the original owners of the material, and at which point the material is returned back to the owner. In the same condition, or almost the same condition that it arrived to us. We don't do anything without the permission of the owner. And
assuming the owner gives permission, you'd like to make those results public. And if it's something,
absolutely. And if we're going to spend a whole lot of money doing what we do, one would hope that the person who owns that material would want it to be public, because that kind of it's justification for their sacrifice and their effort. For holding on to this material and, as you say, keeping hold of it for dear old Granddad, because you're helping advance humanity. You're helping advance who we are as a people and our understanding of the universe and our place in it. So, and of course, that's why we would have to protect, people's privacy, because sometimes people, they want it to become public, but they don't want to be publicly associated with it. So we understand that. And particularly in my work in intelligence, a lot of times you collect information from people. They don't want to be known publicly, but the information is very important. So you report on the information, but you still protect the source, if you know what I mean.
All right. We're talking with Lou Elizondo, Jan Harzan, about remarkable events that are underway as we speak. We're talking with Lou Elizondo and Jan Harzan about ATIP, the Pentagon's ongoing interest in UFOs, the possibility of Congress re-energizing a study. Metamaterials, all kinds of other incidents that maybe we can delve into, similar tic-tac-type encounters, and we'll open up the phone lines as well. We'll take a couple of your calls and questions and comments in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Lou Elizondo, I want to ask you a little bit about some of these other cases like Tic Tac. You know, you had the Nimitz, which had these encounters off and on for several days. And then you watch that video and you listen to the testimony of Dave Fravor and some of the other witnesses. And it seems like this Tic Tac was, you know, these things were just going about their business, not really paying attention to us at all. And at some point they kind of, oh, there's somebody else here. And they kind of react as if, gosh, we didn't know anybody was paying any attention to us. And then, you know, they display this incredible technology. Is that sort of the sense you got about what was going on there, this cat and mouse? And is that sort of what happened with the other Tic Tac encounters? I've heard there have been a dozen, maybe two dozen similar incidents off the East Coast. I know there are limits on what you can say. Can you give me a general sense of, is that Tic Tac encounter similar to what other Tic Tac encounters have been
like? Sure, absolutely. There's some congruencies there that are striking. Some of these haven't been brought to light, so I have to be careful. I keep reminding folks I signed a non-disclosure agreement, and you know, boy, I tell you, one word in the wrong direction, and I could find myself in a whole lot of hot water. So I want to be very deliberate what I say and how I say it.
Sure.
So I think there, you said these things were playing cat and mouse with us. It's a lot like maybe walking down the beach, and you see and I don't know what's going in the mind of these phenomena, but I can only imagine, you know, you're walking down the beach and you see a stray dog at the end of the beach, and you don't really pay much attention to it, and you're doing your thing, and as that stray dog starts to get a little closer and closer, again, you're probably not really worried about it. You have dogs at home, you love animals, but when this stray dog that you don't know and you realize it's a pretty big dog starts to get kind of close to you, maybe you start getting a little bit nervous, maybe you start keeping your eye on it a little bit more, maybe you take a bit of a defensive posture, right? Just in case. So I wouldn't be surprised that as we are flying our aircraft and our assets near one of these things, you get to a point where you cross a certain perimeter. And all of a sudden, now the thing begins to say, okay, you're a little bit too close for comfort. I want to make sure we maintain a safe distance between you and me. And so that may very well be, you know, keeping that degree of operational distance, freedom of movement. Certainly not uncommon that we would see in foreign adversarial aircraft and, frankly, anything that that we encounter. You know, you go to Africa and you see these TV shows where they're flying helicopters and darting the wildebeest down below. When the helicopter's far off in the distance, man, the wildebeest don't really do very much. But when that helicopter gets right over them, boy, they sure run in all directions. And that may very well be what we're seeing here. They're just trying to keep a safe distance from us.
I had heard that there was something like two dozen Tic Tac type encounters off the East Coast in over a period of months. I know you probably can't get into that. And, you know, in looking at the records of other countries, which I know the Bass organization collected information from other countries in Russia, the Russian Ministry of Defense had an order, a standing order, leave these things alone, because in the words of their commander of their Air Force, they could have incredible capacities for retaliation. And that's an exact quote. I imagine you can't say whether we have a standing order like that, but is there any order? Is there any policy about how to engage with these things?
Well, and that's why I'm doing what I'm doing. We need policy on it. You know, silence is not golden in this case. Like I've told people before, you know, this isn't fine wine. This doesn't get better with age the longer we don't talk about it. No, I don't think that's a good philosophy to take. I think if we have a right to national sovereignty and anything that comes into our airspace as an American people, we have a right to know what's there. And that is the job of the Department of Defense. I don't necessarily agree with the Russian perspective to just leave it alone. I certainly wouldn't be provocative. I'm not trying to provoke a fight, but I think we need to learn its capabilities and its intentions and what is it doing in our airspace. I can't fly a Cessna over restricted airspace, so why would we allow something else that we don't even know what it is to do that?
Jan, I'm wondering if, since the Tic Tac video came forward, whether MUFON has gone through its files to look for similar type craft. Have they popped up before? You've heard the argument that, you know, UFOs seem to evolve over time, and they're always just one or two steps ahead of what our aviation or aerospace capabilities are. Is there any evidence that something like Tic Tac has been around for a long time?
Well, I mean, Tic Tac is shaped somewhat like a triangle, and we have plenty of triangular-shaped craft. The thing I found interesting about the video, though, was this was it was a very white light type of a craft. It was almost like it was a blurred image of a triangle. Most of ours are black triangles that we see, and they have white lights in the apexes and then a red light in the center. Some are smooth, some are a little bit more angular in terms of how they're built. But there's not been a conclusive study done on the Tic Tac video. I mean, our folks have analyzed the video. They've looked at it very closely. They couldn't make a determination of what it was, but definitely there's an object there that one of our F-18s is chasing and can't quite catch up to, so that's important to know.
I will say, George, there was some speculation and some theories within the department on the shapes of these crafts. And what I will say is that it was a conclusion of many within the organization that the shape of the craft was a result of the function of the craft. And I'll leave it at that. But whether it's a disc or a Tic Tac, i.e. or a cigar or a triangle, may very well be just a function of the craft, what's intended purposes.
So they're not building something to look good and have tail fins like a Cadillac. They're building something as a function of whatever the technology is, the physics of how it works.
Correct.
Okay. Let's take a couple of calls. First-time caller, Josh in Indiana. Hey, Josh.
George, thanks for taking my call. I have two questions. The first one is, what, other than the fact that this was released by the U.S. government, these recent videos that were chronicled in the New York Times, what is it about these videos that are unique, say, compared vis-a-vis to maybe the release by the Mexican Air Force of some of the video that they have captured of these objects? Is it just that the U.S. government is the one releasing these videos that makes it unique? I guess, is there something on display that they're doing that makes them this such a monumental release? And then question number two, if we were to fast forward to first contact, what about this first contact would make the average day American's lives any different? I think if we're going to move this forward, say, in Congress with greater investigation into the whole thing, we need to kind of frame this in a way that the average person feels like there's some relevance or some importance to how this could impact their lives. What about first contact would eventually trickle down into the average American's life?
Why don't we have Lou take the first question and Jan take the second one?
Sure. Well, thanks for the question. I think it's a really good question. I've had people ask me that before. I think there's many things that make the videos very interesting to the trained eye. And we've had pilots say the same thing. And it's not just the audio, and it's not the fact that the government decided to release them. I mean, those are very important. But I think what makes, for example, let's talk about just as an example, the gimbal video. Let's start with the Nimitz video. Here's a video of an incident where most people said it didn't even occur. And then when it came out on the internet, people were kind of like, well, it's probably not real. It was very real. We actually investigated it. And that's what you see is a video actually from that event taken from an F-18. So that establishes the fact that the event did actually occur. Let's go to the gimbal video for a minute. I think when you hear the pilots talking, you're talking about an object that is at 25,000 feet, and it is orientating itself in a 90-degree angle in 120-knot headwind. Now, aircraft fly. They are a They are a function of their design. An airplane flies in the atmosphere. It has a nose, it has a tail, it has an engine, and it has a definitive shape because it has to fly in the atmosphere. It has to have a leading edge. It has to have ailerons and all the things you would normally characterize and associate with an aircraft. In this particular case, you have something that has no exhaust, something that has no obvious wing surfaces, and something that is orientating itself at a 90-degree angle without falling out of the sky. Doesn't lose altitude, and in fact, is still doing it, moving in a forward direction in 120-knot wind at 25,000 feet up. Now, what makes it even more interesting is when you hear the audio, the individual say there's an entire fleet of them. I cannot go into detail why that's important. I hope at some point the details of that will come out, but it will not come out from me. It isn't just one. And if you know the backstory behind that incident, you're just looking at a very short video, maybe 30, 35 seconds worth. But there's an entire story, weeks and weeks and weeks worth, that go behind that video. And that is what's so compelling. And if those details should come out, I think that's going to be the aha moment, the epiphany, so to speak, where people are going to look and say, holy smokes, that really is an important video. That's not just some blurry thing on the screen.
That's pretty good. So, Jan, maybe you can take the second question, being what is the impact of confirmed first contact?
Well, I think, you know, the one thing that the advantage we have here is we have individuals now who have access to Pentagon videos that are gun camera quality. And I think, you know, that's something we've never really had before. Going back to the early 50s when you had jet fighter pilots chasing UFOs over Washington, D.C., I imagine a lot of video footage has been collected since that time that's in the archives that perhaps now we'll get access to. And I think that's very significant.
Okay, let's take our next caller. Let's see, east of the Rockies, Jim in Somerset, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jim, you're on with Lou and Jan.
Good evening, George. Glad to talk to you. I've been very interested in this subject. I've been involved in investigating UFOs many years ago. I'm a personal friend of J. Allen Hynek. Did some of the investigations for him. I worked at a major research laboratory. I had been following this for quite a while. I know in December, Bob Bigelow was on 60 Minutes, said UFOs were real and alien, wasn't any question about it. Then I heard Mr. Alexandro and Hal Puthoff on your shows in January. I believe one of them was in February. And Hal said toward the end of the show, one of the questions came in, are these craft, whatever they are they of alien nature? And do we have any? And he said, well, all that information is classified, but accidentally one of the reports was released. So, yes, we do have one craft in our possession. The project is still going on, and it was being handled by the Lockheed Skunk Works. He also went into detail on more sightings over our nuclear bases have been repeatedly happening. Also that there was considerably more contact with people having missing time, making contact with apparently being taken for investigation by people, kidnapped, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Abductions.
This was still going on. And then when you were on, you were talking about the air traffic over the East Coast was periodically being interfered with, military and commercial aircraft. And I'm curious, is this definitely of alien nature? I know we don't have anything of the material like that going on at the present time in our government, or we would know about it. And also, Paul Hillier from Canada.
Hey, Jim, I'm going to have to we're going to have to wrap it up, and so we can have time to answer.
Okay,
I appreciate you calling.
Paul Hillier knew about one Project Magnet, but Canada also had three projects.
Yes, I got you. We're familiar with Paul Hillier, but I want to give them a chance to answer sort of the gist of your question there.
Okay, well, thank you. I'll listen on the air. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. So Lou, I mean, alien with air quotes around it, it is alien to us. Alien in the classic E.T. sense. I mean, do we know?
I don't want to answer for Hal Putoff. What he says is what Hal says, and you know, I have no reason to add to what Hal says. I would probably ask Al to expand upon that question if that's what the audience would like him to do. As far as my personal observations, you know, I have time and time again, and again, people think I'm being evasive. I don't feel I have the right to offer my opinion in that area. I want the data, as much as tempting as it may be, because people will glom onto what I'm saying and either jump to a conclusion that I don't want people to jump to. I think we really have to have the self-discipline here and let the data speak for itself. That I think it's premature right now to even ask that question. I know it's enticing for us to ask that question. I know it's tempting, but I think we really, really need to have the self-discipline here and collect more information, because the answer to that question will mean different things to different people. And the data has got to stand on its own. We don't need anybody else adding any type of assertions or innuendos into this. It is already a complex and really tough challenge just to get the basic data points that we need, just to figure out what it is and how it works. I think it would be great if we could get some folks in Congress. Maybe one of the things we could do is establish an academic body to ask some of those questions, have folks from NASA and Bigelow Aerospace and some of the really good folks and Lockheed Martin, Skunk Works and Boeing and all the folks in a room and start asking that question. What does this mean? What does it mean for us as a nation? What does it mean for us as a society? But I dare not. I shudder actually at the thought of giving my opinion on that, only because I don't think I'm qualified to make that statement, to be honest with you, George. It would be disingenuous of me.
I appreciate that view. Jan, I wanted to give you a chance to talk about the MUFON symposium where Lou will speak.
Well, yeah. That's a perfect segue, because, and if I could steal one of Lou's quotes that I've heard him say, is that, you know, whether they're from outer space, inner space, or the space in between, we need to figure that out. I mean, it's one of the most exciting things I think that we could possibly do as a human species. And I would say this, MUFON has been collecting for well over 10 years information from experiencers who have been relating to us their stories of interaction with what I would call non-human entities. And that study, it's been a three-year study that done on that specifically by Kathleen Martin. She'll be sharing those results at the MUFON Symposium. So I would invite anybody and everybody who'd like to come meet Lou firsthand, have a chance to talk to him, ask him your questions. I have found him to be straightforward in everything I've ever asked him about. If he can't answer a question, he'll let you know, and he'll let you know why he can't answer it. But honestly, there are going to be a whole lot of great people there.
And it's coming up next week?
It's coming up
from now?
Starting next Friday, the
20th.
Actually, the 27th. So I don't know if that's exactly next Friday, after maybe. 27th through the 29th in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And you can go on MUFONSymposium.com, get all the information on the speakers and the schedules. Would love to see
I think Dave Politis is one of your speakers?
David Politis is awesome. One of the speakers. Yeah. We've got John Brandenburg. We've got Nick Pope, who was the
Blues counterpart. I'm sorry to say that's a great lineup, but we're out of time. Jan Harzan, Lou Elizondo, thank you both so much. I hope we'll have you both of you back, and I can't wait to hear about the presentation, Lou. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, George.
We'll be right back with Juliana Marinković talking about Croatian UFO cases and the bigger picture. Be right back.